Hello, my dear friends. Greg Kokel here on Stand to Reason. I'm glad you're part of the show. You can always call in, by the way, and I don't give this number out frequently enough, probably. 855-243. Maybe that's why nobody's calling. What do you think? Kyle. 855-243-9975 is the number if you're outside the U.S. Dial or international code number 1. And then 562-424-8229. Either number will get you to Amy. And Amy's the enforcer of sorts, but she's pretty easy as long as you're reasonably civil and have something reasonably coherent to talk with me about, then you'll be on board. In fact, we've got a good question or issue coming up with Michelle in Colorado shortly. She's been waiting for a while, but I wanted to start out this hour just reminding you about Reality Apologetics coming up. We already had our launch this last weekend, and for the entire season, all 6 of our locations, we've tried to box the compass all around the country. So that largely everybody in a region kind of gets a shot. Now, you might have to fly a little bit or drive a little bit. We had a bunch of people come from Arizona, for example, for our event. Characteristically, we have like 15 states that are represented when we have a regional. What we don't have is one like dead center in the United States, like Topeka, Kansas, or something like that, whatever. We've got Seattle coming up. On October 15th and 16th, we've got Minneapolis on November 12th and 13th. We got Dallas on February 25th and 26th. We've got Philly in March. We got Augusta, Georgia in April. So if you want to get any information about any of those, just go to realityapologetics.com. Now, I got to warn you, we sold out in Orange County. We could very well be sold out right now in Seattle. For October. That's a little less than 3 weeks. Is that right? It's 3 weeks? Yeah, 2 weeks from this coming weekend. Is that right? We were almost sold out a week ago. I don't know what the numbers are right now, but give it a shot and see if you can get in if you're not. But we got lots of room in Minneapolis. We were pushing 2,000 people 8 weeks ahead of time. This is November 12th and 13th. And Grace Church, Eden Prairie, which is a huge church, the largest in the state. And so I don't think we're going to have too many limitations with space. Nevertheless, the numbers are adding up fast. And to have 2,000 people signed up 8 weeks in advance is pretty cool. Now, I can see why. We just did the event in Orange County last weekend. And for the rest of the year, all of our locations, it's going to be the same event. The same speakers, the same talks, the same layout. Everybody gets the same every year. And this is from chaos to clarity. We're looking at a culture that is really messed up in lots of different ways. And our team of speakers from the Stand to Reason crowd, Alan Schliemann, Amy Hall. Actually, Amy's doing, no, she is. She's doing a breakout. You're not doing a breakout. Oh, okay. Ask Me Anything. So she is always available the whole time. She's just recovering from this weekend. Had a day off yesterday, but answering gazillions of questions to people who come up to her booth. But Tim Barnett, Natasha Crane, J. Warner Wallace, Megan Allman, Monique Dusson. We have, who did I leave out? Oh, Beckett Cook. I mean, we've got an unbelievable team. John Noyce. Okay, all kinds of stuff that's going to help out. No wonder it's selling out. And lots of fun, too. There was like an unbelievable, I'm just going to kind of minor spoiler alert. There is a rap war that Alan Schliemann does with Tim Barnett, and it's absolutely to die for. But it's on Friday night. Okay, so you got to make sure you make the Friday night. Anyway, all of this stuff coming up, all right, from chaos to clarity, all our events on track at the moment. So just letting you know that was a great success, and I wanted to draw your attention to that. Hey, by the way, maybe it's too late for this announcement. That's what I wanted to say. Some people have asked us about live streaming, video recording available for purchase or live streaming, and we are going to be doing that in the February conference in Texas. So Dallas, Texas, February 25th and 26th. That'll be the North Dallas area. Streaming will be available there. You can go to realityapologetics.com to get the basic information. Now, one thing that I think has been interesting as I look at the social situation is how there have been some unlikely bedfellows pushing back against I'm trying to find the best way to put it that doesn't just sound trite, okay? But pushing back against the pressure from a very verbal and aggressive segment of our society that is meant to control our lives and our thinking. I've talked about the totalitarian impulse of the left for many, many years. I've talked this last year about the actual totalitarian dynamic that is growing and in place in our country. And there are lots of people that are pushing back, not just Christians, not just conservatives, but also those who are centrists and even left of center. And though this doesn't identify a political category, though Christians have been vocal about these concerns, and rightly so. As I mentioned in the last show, one of the things we're to be praying for is for kings and those who are in authority, in the sense that we can, or to the end that, we can lead, as Paul puts it in 1 Timothy chapter 2, verse 2, a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. So there's a lot contained there. There's other concerns as well, but this is one thing that is being challenged, I think, in our culture. And I have mentioned in the past people like Barry Weiss, a female lesbian center, left of center, former writer of the New York Times, and who has resigned under protest because of the political bias, the cultural bias of that paper, no longer interested in truth. And now she's campaigning, even though she still has her own views about things. What she sees is these inequities that are being created in the name of ending oppression and creating justice and all that other stuff. That evil is returning, is being alleged evil, is being answered with evil. Returning evil for evil in the biblical language. And, of course, none of this is new. We've talked about it before. But this is something I just found out a couple of weeks ago. Peter Boghossian is an atheist. In fact, I've written about Peter Boghossian before because he wrote a book called A Manual for Creating Atheists. It's a tactics book for atheists. And in fact, I wrote a piece that you can find on our website called Tactics for Atheists. And Boghossian has done, I think, and what's the right way to put it? I want to say a really good job in this piece, equipping other atheists to be effective in attacking religious people, including Christians, to help create other atheists. Now, when I say good, I mean functionally good. I don't mean it's morally good. It's not a good idea because it's a false idea that he's winning them over to. However, he's clever. And a number of the techniques that I talk about in the tactics book are things that he's employed as well. Not because I think he stole them from me, but because I think the techniques are commonsensical for those who think about them a little bit. So I think he's just on to the same thing. And what's interesting is in his book, he tells his disciples, don't argue for atheism. And he also says, don't argue against theism. Instead, ask questions about faith. That, he thinks, is the Achilles heel, which it is if faith in Christianity was the way Peter Boghossian claims it is. Now, it's a straw man because he has not accurately characterized Christian faith, at least biblically speaking, though there are many Christians who have a blind faith, which is the way he understands it. But that's the Achilles heel, blind faith. And so if you start probing and asking questions, pretty soon you're going to effectively, not his language, mine, but it, it's the same thing. Put a stone in their shoe. Get them thinking, questioning their own convictions, and then that begins to eat away at the Christian, and there is some success he's had with his people in creating atheists from those who identify as Christians. Okay, so anyway, this guy's not on our side, not on that issue. However, he just resigned his position at Portland State University, and he's resigned it because the school has become what he has described as a social justice factory. All right? The students are not being taught to think. So let me read some of his statement, because I think it's telling. Apparently the piece that he wrote in it for resignation is now public, and here's some of the content of that. He writes, "I never once believed, nor do I now, that the purpose of instruction was to lead my students to a particular conclusion." I'll just take that at face value, but it is a little bit hard to believe that a deeply committed atheist would not, in a certain sense, favor that theme in his classes. But nevertheless, I'll just take him at his word. "Rather," he writes, "I sought to create the conditions for rigorous thought to help them," his students, "gain the tools to hunt and furrow for their own conclusions. This is why I became a teacher and why I love teaching. But brick by brick, the university has made this kind of intellectual exploration impossible." Isn't that interesting? The university has made this kind of intellectual exploration impossible. He continues, "It has transformed a bastion of free inquiry into," there it is, "a social justice factory, whose only inputs were race, gender, and victimhood, and whose only outputs were grievance and division." Wow. He continues, "Students at Portland State are not being taught to think. Rather, they're being trained to mimic the moral certainty of ideologues. Faculty and administrators have abdicated the university's truth-seeking mission and instead drive intolerance of divergent beliefs and opinions." Oh, isn't that interesting? This is a point I've made many times. It is the so-called tolerant folk that are the most intolerant. Tolerance is a one-way street when it comes to the left, the secular crowd. All right. He goes on to say, "This has created a culture of offense where students are now afraid to speak openly and honestly." I remember giving a talk a number of years ago in Topeka, Kansas, and I can't remember the name of the school, university there, and I gave a public talk on the problem of evil. And one of the first people up to the microphone was a person who identified himself as a philosophy professor there at the university. Okay, well, we're going to do battle, so to speak, cross swords with a philosophy professor. All right, what's on your mind, sir? First thing out of his mouth, "I'm offended. I'm offended." Now, I have an MA in philosophy, and I promise you, in my discipline where I was trained, being offended would not count as a point against any view, because something offends you doesn't count in philosophy. And given that I was talking about the problem of evil, which is in a certain sense a philosophic problem in the philosophic category of philosophy of religion, you would think that a philosophy professor would offer something philosophically relevant to my point. First thing out of his mouth, "I'm offended." Now, he had more to say that was substantive beyond just that his feelings were hurt. But here is a grown person, an adult, who is not only that, a philosophy professor, who is leading off with "his feelings are hurt." This is what Boghossian is getting at. He said, "This intolerance of divergent beliefs and opinions has created a culture of offense where students are now afraid to speak openly and honestly. Why can't they speak openly and honestly? Because somebody's going to get up to the microphone, a grown-up or a parent grown-up, even a professor, even a philosophy, and say, that hurt my feelings. And what's the result of hurting somebody's feelings? You get canceled. What kind of education is this? That's what Boghossian is saying. Now, apparently, there's been a response from the university, and Portland State has told Fox News, maybe that's where I got this article, I don't know, Fox News, that it is committed to academic freedom and free speech. Really? More, we respect and support the right of faculty, staff, and students to share their views on any platform they choose. Now, part of the complaint that Boghossian has made is that he didn't experience that respect. All right? And really, we respect and support the right of faculty, staff, and students to share their views on any platform they choose. I guess they respect the right to do that. What they don't respect, and this is the way it works out, is them doing that. Because if they do that, even though they, you have a right to do that, but we're going to punish you for exercising your right. That's the dynamic. And that's what Boghossian is complaining about, objecting to, I should say. Anyway, the school told Fox News, Portland State has always been and will continue to be a welcoming home for free speech and academic freedom. We believe that those practices are not in conflict with our core institutional values of student success, racial justice and equity, and proactive engagement with our community. Now, okay, core institutional values. Okay, one is student success, but another one is racial justice. Really? And equity. Okay, that is critical race theory language. And critical race theory is not open to free speech and academic freedom. It just isn't. That is not the way it works out. So in a certain sense, you can't say that we have an institution of value of student success and a commitment to free speech and academic freedom, but we're also committed to so-called racial justice and equity and proactive engagement with our community. How do you feel about pro-life causes? Doesn't that fall under some kind of social justice or at least equity? Equity for those unborn? No, those words are terms of art in CRT. And then they don't want to comment on Boghossian's statement of resignation. And we have a policy against that, they point out. But the article says that other educational professionals have started speaking out against what they see as inappropriate attempts to inject ideology into institutions. And Boghossian's letter alleged that he'd been the subject of harassment and false accusations after speaking out about issues with the university's promotion of critical race theory. All right. He closes with this comment. While I'm grateful for the opportunity to have taught at Portland State for over a decade, it's become clear to me that this institution is no place for people who intend to think freely and explore ideas. By the way, why would a naturalistic, atheistic philosopher at a secular university quit if they actually had a de facto, real practice of academic freedom and liberty to speak freely? It doesn't make sense. He's quitting because he's not experiencing that, regardless of what the university says to the contrary. That's my instincts on this. He says, this is not the outcome I wanted, but I feel morally obligated to make this choice. For 10 years, I have taught my students the importance of living by your principles. One of mine is to defend our system of liberal education from those who seek to destroy it. Who would I be if I didn't? Okay. Well, that's what's happening, liberal education, and that liberal in the really the best sense of the word, not necessarily secular, but liberal in terms of liberal ideals and liberal liberties. No, you're not going to get that at the university. You're going to get indoctrination. It's everywhere. How any secular university, especially this one, being opposed by an atheist, for goodness sake. can, with a straight face, say we're in favor of free speech. We defend the right to free speech. Maybe in the abstract, but in practical terms, no. Doesn't happen. Incidentally, just revisiting this theme of strange bedfellows, Corey Miller, who is the president of Ratio Christi, is actually been on the road with Peter Boghossian together on the same side, campaigning against political correctness and in its various forms, including CRT, critical race theory. So that's kind of interesting. That and I've talked to Corey about this. Corey can be palling with Pete doing this thing because they share the same views on this particular issue. So, all right, let's take a break. Now we'll go to calls on Stand to Reason.
Do you know that killing an unborn human being is against the law in most states? The only exception is when the mother wants her child dead and asks a doctor to kill it. Then it's legal, it's protected, it's funded by our tax dollars. And today, the freedom to choose is even celebrated. We live in a world where a woman decides whether another innocent and defenseless human being lives or dies. But is it that simple? Don't women have a right to control their own bodies? Can't many poor women not afford to have another baby? Should a woman who was raped be forced to carry the criminal's baby? It's complicated. It's chaos. But there's a solution. There's a way to make sense of the confusion. We need to anchor our thinking about abortion to reality. Then we'll see how we can help both unborn human beings as well as their born mothers who face a difficult decision. Join us for this year's Reality Conference, where we'll see how the solution to abortion will bring clarity to the chaos. Go to realityapologetics.com to get dates and locations for the Student Apologetics event of the year.
When you choose to support Stand to Reason with a monthly gift of $10 or more, you become a strategic partner in the work of equipping Christian ambassadors. Your monthly commitment makes you a part of a special group, helping STR-trained Christians to confidently and graciously defend their convictions. Your monthly gift helps us plan and manage STR's resources and provides consistent support to aid our ongoing work. As our thanks for your partnership, we have created some benefits to express our gratitude, like a 10% discount in our online store, access to a private Facebook group, and more. To become a strategic partner, visit str.org/donate. Click How Often Will You Donate? And choose Monthly. For personal assistance, you can email Ocean Wilson at ocean@str.org.
All righty. Just a reminder, since I had this question at Reality this weekend, gee, do you guys do any other kinds of things? Can you come to other people's conferences and the like? And the answer is yes. We go where we're invited. So if you would like to invite any Stand to Reason personality, person, individual, teacher, speaker, however you want to characterize them, to your church service, to your youth group, to your conference, you can do so. Just send an email to booking@str.org. And Tim and Alan and John and me, we are all available in principle for your event. We just have to work out the details, okay? So that would be booking@str.org. Okay, time to get to Michelle. Michelle, we made it.
Yay!
Yay!
How are you today, Mr. Coco?
Yes, nice to talk with you. Thank you.
All right, I have two questions. The first one's about critical race theory, and the second one's about discipleship.
Sure.
So I guess I'll start with the first one.
Okay.
Let's get that out of the way. Get that one out of the way and get to the good stuff. So I'm involved in a number of different Christian organizations, like volunteering and also work in a kind of an area of Christian ministry. But I just see like critical race theory getting into so many organizations, and then recently a lot of
yes, unfortunately, sadly,
kind of respect and listen to a lot, you know, kind of endorsing it now and saying no, this is the way we should go. I can understand to some extent how that could happen, because I myself kind of got pulled into it for a while. until I started actually reading the works of critical race theorists, then I was like, that's not right.
Yeah. Interesting.
But I don't really know what to do or move forward when I see Christian leaders doing this. And I want to do something about it because I see it hurting the church, but I don't really know
okay.
what to do.
There's two, you asked the question, how could this happen? And I think there are two reasons. And both of them are things I noticed fairly quickly as this gained ascendancy. And the first thing is that because Christians have the moral concerns about the world that they do, because they're Christians, they are concerned with virtue. They are concerned with individual virtue and with cultural virtue, civic virtue, if you will. And so, therefore, when there is bona fide injustice, they feel the need, appropriately, to speak to the injustice, okay? So they are, when something is described as racial justice or social justice or sexual justice or whatever, the justice word catches their subconscious because they care about justice. All right. I hear a kind of a cackling in the background. Do you guys hear that? Is that what
that, that might be some noise in the background.
Oh, okay. All right. It's not our stuff. Okay. Oh, it just went away. Oh, we just called it out, and then it snuck away. All right, perfect. So I think there is an understandable and virtuous animus Christians have regarding these things when they see them present. Let's do something about this wrong in our culture. This makes them, trying to think of the best way to put this, I almost said vulnerable. I guess that's the right word. This makes them vulnerable. A desire to do good regarding justice makes them vulnerable to claims of injustice, even when the claims may not be sound, and the project that is meant to address the injustice may itself be unjust. Okay? So they may not see that. Christians are, I think, largely naive. Like a lot of people, you don't see the bad things coming. I read the book of Proverbs a lot, and I think that reading Proverbs helps me to understand how the world works and helps me to understand human nature. And because of that, and also because of my training, I can see nonsense coming from a long way off. And I could see that with this whole approach long ago, all right? But most Christians can't see that. And so if there's a charge that there is racial injustice that is systemic in our country, if that's the case, then we ought to do something about it. In fact, when the George Floyd thing came down, I even had staff members that were saying, are we as a country really this bad? Is this really a characteristic of our country, the claims and charges that were being made, the broad claims and charges that were being made regarding that were kicked off, especially by that event? It happened in Ferguson a few years ago, but then this event really sparked a wildfire and a conflagration, quite literally, in Minneapolis, also Portland and Seattle and other places where these sentiments were being acted out in violent ways, all right? So Christians have a vulnerability to claims of injustice. That's one thing. Here's another part, though. This is how I think the other element that I saw earlier, that the powers that be, all right, now I'm using my language carefully, because in a certain sense, the whole project that is being advanced here is characterized sometimes as speaking truth to power. You've heard that phrase, right?
I've heard that a lot.
Okay, speaking truth to power. Here's the irony when it's being used by the people who use it, is first of all, they don't care about truth. Truth is not a value that they have. It just isn't. And they are the power. It is the left that controls the vehicle of power in this country. Now, what they might want to say is, well, there's this institutional thing that's going on that's still got a life of its own that we have to tear down. Okay, that's the whole institutional systemic racism kind of claim. But in practical terms, day to day, this is where the power lies. And since they have the power, they have the power to punish dissidents. I'm going to say it again. They have the power to punish dissidents. Why do you think my caller from the last show, and you, I think you're on hold, Dan, did not want to identify where he was from? He said it, why he didn't want to identify. There was a risk. And some people now, when they talk about these things, they call in and they identify them as themselves as anonymous. They don't even want to give their first name or their location. Why? Because somebody might be listening to this Christian show who might figure out who it is and then take it out on them. That's why they call in anonymously. What does this tell you? Is that the left has the power to punish dissent. And people are feeling it. So I think some of what's going on here in response to your question, how Christian people can give into this, in one, there's a legitimate and a noble impulse to do justice or see that justice is done that makes them sometimes naive to false claims of injustice that need to be addressed. Secondly, there is this dynamic by those who are in power, which is the left, of punishing dissent on their take regarding the injustice issues. And by the way, I think this explains the way of some I'm not going to talk about this this weekend. I mean, now, maybe next week. But the way Campus Crusade for Christ has responded to an issue that just came up a few days ago, that and I think this is the way a lot of people are responding. They are coming down very, very hard on what may to some appear to be untoward comments that might relate to race, and they lower the boom and throw people under the bus. Why? I tell you, my opinion is they're afraid of the left. They're afraid of the left. They don't want to get canceled. So this dynamic is alive and well, even in the body of Christ. It may also be that some people in these organizations are convinced of the legitimacy of the charges against America. And so they think these are legitimate charges, and so they are on board with them. Plus, if they seem to protect anyone who steps out of line, then they're stepping out of line with the left as well, and they're going to get hammered. And I think that that explains a lot.
That makes sense. Hmm. So then I guess what to do about that, just I'm a normal person, but I don't want to just sit and do nothing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, there's.
But I don't know what
I have to recommended
do.
A book before. In fact, I think later in the fall I'll be interviewing I can't remember his name. Rod Dreher. Dreher, that's it. I almost said Shearer. Rod Dreher. And his book is called Live Not by Lies. And I highly recommend it. It's very readable. It's a real stunner. It does recommend things that individual Christians can do. And the title suggests that. Even if we can't change the world, we can keep the world from changing us. And if we choose to live not by lies, even as individuals, that can eventually have an impact on the culture, is what he has argued. But even if it doesn't have an impact on the culture, we can still choose to live not by lies, but by truth. But then we're going to have to suffer the consequences that the culture metes out. It's punishment of those who break ranks.
Makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Sorry.
All right. Now for the happier question. I've been wanting to start like a discipleship group or be more hands-on in discipling other people. And I heard a previous podcast where you were talking about how you've done that pretty regularly since you've been a Christian. I'm just wondering, how do you start like a discipleship group? I don't really even know where to begin.
Well, in some ways, it's kind of simple. All discipleship is a kind of a process of reproduction where you're trying to pass some things on from yourself to someone else. So you can think of it like mentoring. And you are, what a mentor does is he has some capability that the mentee doesn't. So there's a hierarchy there, all right? So you have a person who's a really good carpenter, and then you have a neophyte. And then the really good carpenter takes the neophyte under his wing and transfers the skills and walks them through the things and helps them with that stuff, okay? And that's how that mentoring is done. Well, in a very straightforward fashion, a very similar fashion, a discipleship is accomplished. And what you see conceptually here is that you are a Christian woman who has something to offer someone who is, in a certain sense, less capable or less mature in the Lord than you are. And you're going to pass those some of those things on. So the with that in mind, when you are seeking to disciple, if you follow Jesus' pattern, the discipler chooses the disciples. So they see somebody that they would like to invest themselves in, and they initiate a relationship like that. So that could happen with an individual or a group. And I know that, for example, my brother's wife, Barb, she had an individual that she discipled using some curriculum, some material that she was going through. And it was a way of tutoring using the material, the younger Christian in their faith, and passing it on. There was a season for that, and then it ended. And I have, over the years, have had many, many groups. As it turned out, just about everybody on our long-term staff now, everybody on our staff had been a part, even Amy, had been a part of a group that met at my home on a regular basis, weekly or twice a month, for about a year. And it was my way of investing myself in them, okay? So, and there's been lots and lots of people that I've been able to do that with. And now I'm doing it a little bit more informally. We don't have a weekly, but I do it with my staff, and actually on Thursday with my young guns, so to speak, my content people, our speakers here, then we're having a meeting on Wednesday, on Thursday, and we're going to talk about things. So what am I? I'm investing myself in them, answering their questions, helping them with things, trying to guide them with the wisdom such as I have regarding issues that come up. Probably the way this is most often done for people is they have some kind of curriculum that they employ to help people move forward with their convictions. If you're dealing with a young Christian, you're going to be focusing on very, very foundational things. Campus Crusade for Christ has got material for discipleship on that. They've had for years and years and years. I don't know what's available now, but there's material, all kinds of material that's developed for that. Different people have it. You could disciple in a particular area, like in apologetics or something like that, or but what I would say here, let me make two suggestions. Here's the first one. I suggest that you get a book that was very helpful for me in understanding discipleship the way Jesus did it. And this was a book I read 50 years ago, and it's still a very popular book now. Okay? You ready for the title?
I'm ready.
Okay. It's called The Master Plan of Evangelism. The Master Plan of Evangelism, and the author is Robert Coleman, C-O-L-E-M-A-N. I actually met Robert Coleman once many years ago, and I got at Grove City College, and I got a chance to say thank you for his book. And then a number of years after, I met his grandson at Summit Ministries, and it was really crazy because his grandson said, "You know what? You remind me a lot of my grandfather." It's kind of a sideways compliment, right? It's like a backhanded compliment. Okay, who's your grandfather? Robert Coleman. I said, well, that's pretty high praise. So he is somebody who's written a book called The Master Plan of Evangelism that looks at Jesus' method of discipleship. And so this will help give you a general understanding for how Jesus planned to reach the world. He didn't plan through mass evangelism events. He planned to reach the world through a process of multiplication called discipleship. So I recommend that book. Then I would start praying, and I would encourage you to pray, Lord, show me people that are in my life that I can initiate a discipleship relationship with, and also help me to find some curriculum that I can use. Now, I don't know anything about you, Michelle, personally. In my case, I just put my own stuff together. So that was kind of in my wheelhouse. And so I just kind of put things together, and I still am doing this. But some people have a basic curriculum that they follow, that a book of that follows fundamentals of Christianity. And this is one of the most important things you could do. Doctrinal fundamentals and then spiritual life fundamentals. Doctrinal fundamentals, like what does Christianity teach that's important and foundational? Let's get really clear on that. And how do I nurture my own relationship with God? Through prayer, through Bible reading, through Bible study, through spiritual disciplines of various sorts. And I wish I had this thing. I could say, here it is. Here's the turnkey enterprise. Just do this. But I don't have that. And I don't think there is such a thing like this is the perfect discipleship program. But there's a lot of them that are pretty good.
Okay.
And if you go to discipleship, look up discipleship, go to Amazon and type in Christian Discipleship Manual or something and see what you find. Different organizations have had different manuals, like a Freudian slip there. Campus Crusade for Christ had one, for example, with transferable concepts. InterVarsity has had. The reason I balked there is because both of these organizations are now, as far as I could tell, being influenced deeply by critical race theory. But, you know, read something, old stuff, you know, find some old, think of the people that you want to walk through. Are they brand new Christians? Are they fairly new Christians? Have they been around for a while? What are their needs? What are the kinds of things that you, Michelle from Colorado, can give to those individuals to help them grow in their own convictions and in their stability and their foundation in Christ?
Okay.
So I would suggest those kinds of things.
I'm from a missionary family, so I'm kind of a creation through the cross kind of person.
Oh, okay.
Like a whole picture of God's story. So
sure. Well, that's great.
That's kind of the materials that I think I would tend to gravitate towards.
Good. Well, the key is you're looking to transfer information from a more mature Christian to a less mature Christian, for a season. And you want a commitment from those people. You say, look, here's what I have in mind to do, and are you on board? And you can make it 6 months, a year, once a week, however. In my case, because Craig Englert was a teacher at the school, at the community that I was living in, I saw him almost every day. And so there were things that we had met together and as a group with others were being taught. Okay. One of those guys in that group was Randy Phillips, and Randy Phillips became the president of Promise Keepers. Believe it or not. I mean, it's amazing what God does, right? But other times we would just go to things together. One of the keys you'll find out from the Master Plan by Coleman is that Jesus spent time with his disciples. So if you bring people along with you who are your disciples to spiritual events or things like that so that they can see you living your spiritual life out, you know, in a meaningful way. So this is under the category of being caught, not taught. But that's a part of what Coleman talks about. So part of what I would do then is like I would drag some of my guys or get whatever, my team members along with me when I go to something. So we could do it together. And this has happened in the past. And now, of course, we, you know, we're moving into a different phase. But so you get the idea.
Yeah, that's very helpful. Thank you so much.
Okay, Michelle, I'm glad to be able to chat with you about both of those issues, and I appreciate your call.
Thank you so much.
Okay,
bye.
Bye-bye now. All right, let's take a break, and we'll come back for more questions on Stand to Reason. Friends, if you like this broadcast, I know you'll love hashtag STRAsk. It's our shorter 20-minute podcast where I am paired with the wonderful Amy Hall, and together we answer the questions you send us on Twitter. Hashtag STRAsk is released twice a week, Mondays and Thursdays, and it's only about 20 minutes long, so it's perfect to listen to on your morning jog or while driving around running errands or cleaning your garage or just plain loafing at home. Amy and I tackle your questions on theology and ethics and culture and lots more, offering our insight on the questions you're asking or the challenges you face. You can listen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you download your own shows. Just remember, send us your questions on Twitter using the name of the podcast, hashtag STRAsk. That's hashtag STRAsk.
Have you ever wondered how Stand to Reason is able to produce fresh, accessible content each week? We rely on generous donors so that we can provide you with the tools and tactics you need to be an effective ambassador for Christ. If you've benefited from this podcast or any of our donor-provided resources, including our apps, blog posts, articles, and short videos, consider making a financial contribution to Stand to Reason today. Just visit str.org/donate to show your financial support. It has been an honor providing you with a host of free resources for more than 27 years to help you give voice to the Christian worldview. Help us continue by making a financial gift today at str.org/donate.
Final segment here of Stand to Reason. And, you know, I don't get the phone number out enough, so I'm going to do it now. And it's not because there are people listening live, probably, maybe on streaming, but it's so you know that you can call in during the show, which is 4 to 6 p.m. Pacific time on Tuesdays. And that number is 855-243-9975. I say that partly because we've had like a slow stream of callers. Actually, not a stream, but just we've had a lot of time where we haven't had that many callers. And I don't know if you guys know that it's not that hard to get in. You may have to wait a little while. That's okay. But I have some questions here, though, that people have sent in because they haven't been able to call, but they just sent it in. And so in these downtimes like this, I can refer to them. So two lessons there. If you want to call, you can. 855-243-9975, 4 to 6 p.m., Tuesdays, L.A. time, West Coast time. Or if you just can't do that and you listen to the podcast, you can send your question in. And there's a, I guess on the website, is that right, Amy? There's a broadcast question form. Okay, so you can do that. And then we get those and I can answer your question then. And here, so there you go. And here I go. I'm going to answer one. And here is the question from John somewhere in California. Assuming that two women had abortions only for the sake of convenience, and the two women did not have any health problems. One had it while she was 1 month pregnant. The other had it while she was 8 months pregnant. Are they equally heinous and serious? Please explain your answer. And my simple answer to that is yes. And it's not difficult to know why. But you have to backtrack for a moment and ask the question. This is the question we always ask as the foundational question that needs to be answered in order to simplify the issue and get to the heart of the moral question about abortion. And that question is, what is the unborn? Now, abortion kills something that's alive. That's the point. It's people say, well, nobody knows when life begins. Is it growing? Yes. Then it's alive. All right? It's as simple as that. If it's growing, it's alive. So we know it's alive. This is not a mystery, and this is not rocket science. All right? okay, so it's something alive, and you're killing some living thing. If I were to ask you, just kind of out of the blue, hey, can I kill this? Would you be able to answer without knowing what it was I was asking you about? No, you couldn't. You have to know what a thing, what thing is being killed before you know whether or not it's right to kill the thing. So with regards to abortion that kills something, what is being killed? Excuse me. And the answer is really simple. It's very simple. It's straightforward. Religion has nothing to do with it, though I can make a biblical argument about this. I don't need to. I can just make a philosophical / scientific argument. The thing that is growing inside of mom, and there's a clue, it's mom, and she's only a mom if she's got a child. The child doesn't become a human when it comes out of the womb. That's just a change of location. That growing thing inside that is growing from the point of conception is a human being and will remain a human being until that individual dies, whenever that happens to be. 2 months, 4 months, abortion, miscarriage, 1 year outside the womb, baby dies, all the way, whatever, to the end. It still remains what it is. It does not matter whether the woman is, I'm reading the question here, 1 month pregnant or 8 months pregnant, any more than it matters if the baby is 1 month old or 8 months old. When you kill that baby at 1 month or 8 months, you're still killing an innocent human being. It is just as egregious to kill a child outside of the womb, regardless of the age. So, by application, inside of the womb is no different. Now, what is different is the way the child looks, the developing human being looks. Now, some people want to say, well, that's not a human, that's a fetus. Wait a minute, a fetus isn't a kind of thing. It's a stage of development of a thing. The question is, what kind of fetus is it? All kinds of feti. There are dog feti, cat feti, squirrel feti. What kind of fetus is it? It's a human fetus. That is, it's a human being at a fetus stage of development. Or earlier than that, a zygote, or later than that, a child, a newborn, an infant, a toddler, an adolescent, an adult, an old person. They're all the same human being. The only relevant difference some people think is that the location is different. Well, they look different, but looking different doesn't matter. An acorn's not an oak, you're right. The seed is not the adult, but an acorn is an oak, no less than a full-grown, mature tree is an oak. They're both oaks. They're just oaks at different stages of development. So the unborn at all stages of development is what it is. The same thing it is when it makes its debut, when that child is born. It's a human being. Okay? And if it's wrong to take the life of an innocent human being for the reasons people have abortion, then it doesn't matter how old the human being is. 50 years old, 20 years old, 10 years old, 5 years old, 1 year old, 9 months gestation, 8 months gestation, 3 months gestation, 1 day gestation. It's the same act of destruction on the same kind of valuable human being. So the timing doesn't make any difference. I know people get lost up in the, well, this, it doesn't look human. And the answer to that is, of course it looks human. It looks exactly like all human beings look at that stage of development. Now, it might be at certain stages of development, you can't know whether that thing is a human when in a certain sense, analyzed in isolation. So you could have all these fetuses. And you say, well, what kind of fetus is that? Well, I don't know. They all look kind of the same at this stage of development. But just because you can't distinguish them by eyesight, by looking at them, doesn't mean they aren't distinguished. They aren't different fetuses. And if you wanted to do the DNA number, you could distinguish them right away, because human beings have human DNA signatures. I was going to say fingerprints, but that's not quite right. they have a fingerprint too, in a certain sense, DNA, in that their DNA is unique. But their unique DNA has the signature of being human DNA. So there is a way you could tell, even if you can't tell by eyes. But it doesn't matter. It is still what it is. And if that fetus had not been removed from the womb, you'd know before long what kind of fetus it was, because other more recognizable features would present themselves. So you'd know whether this was human fetus or a squirrel fetus or a rabbit fetus or a Fido fetus or whatever. But that doesn't change what it is. And so sometimes people get caught up in this, well, it looks kind of amorphous to me. Yeah, so do some, you know, teenagers. So do some grown-ups look somewhat amorphous. Well, that's just a blob of tissue, people say to me. Well, so I tell them, so are you. You're just a bigger blob. That's all. I mean, strictly speaking, we're all blobs of tissue. That doesn't answer anything regarding the nature of the unborn. We have to figure out what it is. Once we figure out what it is, then we know what our moral obligations towards it happen to be. And what we discover, of course, is the unborn at every stage of development are full, complete, self-regulating organisms. And the kind of organism they are, by the way, they're distinct from their mother's body because they have a different human fingerprint. Both have human signatures because they're both human beings, but the child has a different human fingerprint. And as we watch it develop, we can see these occasions, see these distinctions. And so what's growing in there is not mom. It's a separate human being and will remain that human being, that self, for as long as it exists. The question is whether we are going to unjustly destroy that human being simply because it doesn't look like us. Anyway, hope that helps you, John, on your question about abortion. That's it for the show, friends. Thank you for being part of it. I'm Greg Kokel here for Stand to Reason. Give them heaven, all right? Bye-bye.